Yo, my peoples, welcome to Rants and Randomness. I'm Lovie Ajayi, your side-eye sorceress, and this is my podcast where I'm talking about the things I'm loving, the things that I'm side-eyeing, and interviewing really interesting people. I'm here at the Chicago Recording Company to bring y'all the radio voice as always. Happy 2019, by the way. Excited to be back in the studio. On this episode, my feel-good is my trip to West Africa for the holidays with my friends, ranting about this government shutdown and why our president is ridiculous, and spotlighting Marie Kondo's Tidying Up show, which I'm now obsessed with. And I'm interviewing Natasha S. Alford, award-winning journalist, host, and speaker. It's going to be a good show, so let's jump into it. Yo, I am feeling good because I just came back from a two-week trip to Nigeria and Ghana for the holidays. And what was just a trip to begin with, I feel like turned into like a life-changing experience. I went with my crew, the West African Voltron, who I've talked about before on this show. And it was just an epic 2 weeks. 2 weeks of gallivanting all over our homeland, it was like salve for the soul. We did so much in that time, and it felt like we were gone for a month. I was sharing all of it on social media, on Instagram, so I wanted to bring people along with me because I already knew the shenanigans were going to be high. But I just didn't realize how impactful the time would be. So first we did Nigeria, December 20th to the 27th, and there we got apartments. Shout out to Airbnb for putting us up in these dope apartments in Victoria Island, Ekoa Atlantic specifically. So while there, y'all, we were doing so much. We did an Ankara and Tea event hosted by the dope Tosin Joratoye of Bloom Africa. So me, my girl Bozema St. John, my girl Justina Omokwa, Funa Maduka, my boo, we spoke at this brunch that Bloom Africa threw, and we had on dope outfits by this amazing designer, Lanre Da Silva Ajayi. We share a last name, so I'm going to start saying we're cousins. So we did that. We rented out a beach house for a day. We went to the Oba of Lagos' palace, the king of Lagos, where we were served dinner under the stars. We went to All Black Everything event hosted by my boy T.Y. Works, where yours truly, me, in all my young old glory, actually stayed out till 6 a.m. that day partying. It was so fun. So in Nigeria, we all barely slept because we were just up at all hours of the night. If anyone has ever been to Lagos, Lagos is like New York on steroids. The city never sleeps. So we were always doing something. Even when we were indoors, we were talking on our terrace, having a good time. We barely slept. And you know, our bodies are not really meant to do that in your 30s. So there were days where some of us didn't get up until 3 p.m. because we were trying to catch up on sleep. So after Lagos, we took a plane that we called Soul Plane, 30 of us, because it was 30 of us there. We went to Ghana. It was a one-hour flight. And Ghana it was a completely different trip and feel. It was more cultural, less partying, and then more people. Because Ghana basically was the Full Circle Festival, which was created by Bozema St. John. She did it to bring friends to Ghana to learn about the richness of the country, the culture, and to make sure that Ghana is a place that people, that helps people feel more connected to their roots, especially African-Americans who are trying to figure out, like, what part of Africa am I from? So she brought on Boris Kodjo as a partner, and that week in Ghana was spent really digging deeper into what this country had to offer. It was 100 of us on the Full Circle Festival. So we took over this hotel, the Mövenpick in Accra. We had a private breakfast with the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo. We brought in New Year's watching fireworks, and then we ended up on the beach playing in the ocean where we had breakfast. We ended up having an audience with the king of Akwamu, the one who was featured on Humans of New York a couple of months back. And there he actually installed Bose as Queen Mother. Epic, okay? We also then visited Cape Coast, which is super. That was the experience that I think left the biggest mark on me. We went to the Elmina castles, the slave castles, where the door of no return is. It's where so many of Africans who were sold into slavery were forced into the ships And it's where the Middle Passage kind of began. So we got to go into some of the dungeons. We heard the stories of some of the cruelty that happened there. A lot of us broke down while there. It was such a powerful place, and I really hope more people go. I did a series of stories on my Instagram around it that's actually saved in my highlights. So you can go on at Lovey on Instagram, look on the highlights. There's one called Cape Coast. Take a look there, because you'll see as we went through the dungeons, as we lit lights in these places where it was just meant to steal people's spirits and break their spirits down. Yeah, the trip was amazing. I just remember the times we were going to the market or just sleeping on the buses that shuttled us around and how we were given the VIP treatment. I'm really, really, really proud of my sis, Bozeman St. John, for turning her trip back to Ghana that started last year into a bridge that could impact generations. And Ghanaians know how to welcome you. Akwaaba is the word for welcome, and what they did was show us that Akwaaba is a verb. The whole trip was dope. I'm still recovering. There's the reason why I've been going to sleep at 10 p.m. every night. I'm still jet lagged a little bit, but I think my body's kind of like, I need you to be quiet for a little bit. So, but yes, man, the trip was epic. I miss all the people I was on the trip with, and my Voltron squad. We got even closer. If you can travel with your friends, you can do anything together. There are a lot of people who can't travel together. There are a lot of people who don't know how to act in big groups. It was a testament of how dope folks are that we had no problems in the 2 weeks we rolled together. So, yeah, man, y'all go check out my Insta stories highlights on my Instagram account, and so you can see all the stuff we did. This week's rant is about the government shutdown and why our president, I don't even say our, y'all president, continues to lower the bar to the point where the bar is not even in the ground. Like, it's like under the basement. So at this point, the government shutdown has been going on for 26 days. And so far, it is the longest shutdown in America's history. Almost a month and people are not being paid. This is the work of Cheeto Satan and his representatives, who basically using the wall to hold America ransom. This need to build a random wall across 2,000 miles of American border to Mexico. This giant tantrum that is now impacting millions of people. 78% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, right? Which means the people who've gone the last 26 days without any money coming in are struggling, okay? Because most people don't have a fat savings account. Most people don't have a trust fund to pull things out of. Most Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. So 26 days of not being paid is major. It's how people miss mortgage payments. It's how people can't go to work because they can't afford transportation. Most Americans cannot afford an emergency that costs $400. So how are these hardworking people gonna afford not getting a paycheck? At this point, people have missed, I would say, two paychecks, because 26 days, yeah, two paychecks. 25% of government workers are furloughed. What does that mean? It means they're not paid or they're getting reduced pay, if that is the term of their employment, for a set period of time. When that time is up, they get no money at all. So government workers who have to show up every single day do not know the next time they're going to get paid. They have to figure out where to get the money to get to work. They have to figure out whether they're picking daycare or going to work themselves. The whole thing is just so infuriating, because the fact that the president of the United States is throwing a tantrum and saying, I'm not going to pay y'all, essentially, until the people who you voted in do the thing you don't want them to do, which is to make me pay for, which is to like give American dollars to build a stupid wall that's not going to do anything, that is not going to enhance security, because that's not how this works. Also, America doesn't even have a clean 2,000 miles worth of property that can even use to build a wall. I don't understand what is happening here. So on top of all of that, TSA workers are also being unpaid. So airport security is compromised. How does it make sense to say, I want to build a wall to make America more safe, when you're not paying the people who are ensuring that anybody who's getting on flights are not compromised? I think TSA workers are to the point where they don't even give a damn anymore. There have been a whole bunch of stories in the last couple of days about how the TSA, the loudspeakers at JFK Airport have been playing rap music because TSA employees can actually control certain music going through terminals. So now they playing all types of, like, Ludacris, which I'm here for it. They keep that same energy. If y'all not getting paid, you might as well be having fun at work. Turn JFK Airport into the club, okay? Turn it into the club. Unfortunately, it's also making travel much more inconvenient because now TSA workers are calling in to work, which I can't blame them, which means lines at security are much longer than they should be or that we're used to. It's all bad. It is all bad. So when is this government shutdown going to end? Some people are predicting that this could go into February, right? The administration is telling banks to work with government worker woes. So some banks are like, fine, we will loan you money for your mortgage payment. But the thing is, people still have to pay that back. And what that's creating is more a cycle of debt. Right. So people are going to come back. They're going to get their checks. But then now you owe somebody some more money, which is not a good thing. The government shutdown is probably going to make a lot of people's credits drop because missed mortgage payments can cost up to 100 points on your credit report. The SBA is not making loans. So Small Business Administration is not making loans, and small business accounts for more than half of America's businesses. USDA, the farmers are not getting loans. Immigration cases are on crazy backlog. So again, how does this make this country more secure? Farmers are not getting their subsidy payments. The FCC is not doing IPOs. FDA, and here's a part two that's crazy. The FDA, which regulates our food, is not doing semi-annual inspections. We just had lettuce recalled, okay? So what happens when the FDA, the people who are supposed to make sure that our food is safe, are not doing inspections? That means the food that's going to be in our grocery stores, who knows what type of criteria is attached to them? People are just going to be eating whatever. That's not safe, which is going to create health problems, which in a country that's already not giving us free health care, who is it going to affect? Poor people who do not have health care. So it's just this horrible cycle. All for what? This stupid wall that is not going to do anything good but make the country look like the Soviet Union. I don't understand how this makes any sense. It's all crazy. This president is insane. Like, he's the one who just had the Clemson Tigers over to the White House, 76 people. And because White House's cooks are furloughed, instead of getting them and catering really good food for these champions that he's supposed to be honoring, this man went and bought McDonald's and 300 hamburgers, which when he tweeted about it were 1,000 hamburgers. Every time I think he cannot go any lower, every time I think he cannot do something more embarrassing than the last thing he does, he goes, challenge accepted. I'm just embarrassed for us all because the president of the United States is so tacky that he will serve McDonald's burgers on White House china because his cooks can't even cook these people food because he wants a wall. And until he gets his wall, he is pausing the government. I don't understand, y'all. We are basically living in a giant SNL skit or an Onion article that just refuses to end. I want to get off this ride. I don't know how to get off this ride. And 2020 can either be really bad because if he gets reelected at this point, I don't know, or really good in that we get him out. But the dream is Mueller. He comes through, okay? We're looking at you, Mueller. We need you. We need you, sir. So, yeah, this government shutdown, I really hope it ends soon. I'm so sorry to anybody who's been affected by this. And I really hope for relief soon. and that you are able to get paid again. Yeah. Sorry about this, man. America, we're going to do better. We're going to do better. That's the goal. On a good note, my spotlight this week is about Marie Kondo's new Netflix show, Tidying Up, and her KonMari method of tidying. It is giving me all the life. So Marie Kondo is a best-selling author of a book called The Life-Changing Art of Tidying, and that book has sold millions of copies over the last couple of years. The book flew off the shelves as it dropped all the gems because it's talking about how to live a life that sparks joy through tidying up. That sounds real basic, right? You're like, okay, until you watch it or you like actually take it on. So I haven't read the book, but I heard about this new Netflix show about Marie Kondo. Well, starring Marie Kondo is called Tidying Up. So I took a look and I end up binge watching 4 episodes in one sitting. Marie, in each episode, goes into people's homes and helps them declutter. So in the process of her just helping them declutter, she ends up changing their lives because we realize our attachment to things can affect our lives and the quality of life that we live. So imagine you're walking into your home every day, stepping over coats, and then there's no room in your master bedroom because you have clothes all over the place. How do you sleep well? So in each episode, one family, and she basically goes in, figures out their space, and gives them assignments. She makes them do the work themselves, but she basically helps them through it. But one thing that I love about her show and what she does is before she starts working, she greets the house. She basically thanks it for holding the space and holding these people's stuff. And I don't know whether it's because they play sappy music as she does it, but I've almost cried a couple of times as she's greeting these houses. The show is so good. I am obsessed. I'm officially obsessed with all things Marie and KonMari. Like, I bought the book now. I've watched YouTube videos and basically subjected everyone that I know to the pressure of tidying up their lives. I've been also trying to tidy up my digital life because of it. The question that Marie asks people to use whenever they want to pick what they're keeping or what they're donating or giving away is, does this thing spark joy? So she makes people put, for example, she makes you tidy up by categorizing your things. So you tidy up first with clothes. All the clothes you own, she will throw it on a bed or on a floor. Like, you have to see it all in one big pile because it lets you understand. A lot of us think we own way less than we do until you see it. But then she wants you to touch each thing and ask, does this thing spark joy? If it does not spark joy, give it away. If it does spark joy, you keep it. I think it's really good. It's a really good question to do across the board for anything. So I was like, ooh, I should use the same question to tidy up my digital life. The people who I'm following, are they sparking joy or not? So I've unfollowed some people in the last couple of weeks. But yeah, truly, the way she organizes, the way she folds stuff, it actually saves space. It clears people's minds because when you see your floor again after you hadn't seen it in months, you might feel a little bit better. And Marie Kondo's so sweet. She doesn't judge nobody. Bless her. She don't even make people feel bad about their clutter, even though they're mini hoarders. But the show's so good. It is on season 1 on Netflix. I think there's 8 episodes. I've watched the first 4. I'm going to go binge the other 4 probably this weekend. And it's so good. It's so good. Go watch it and tell other people to watch it and tidy up your life. We are a cluttered society. So we buy a lot of things. We accumulate a lot of things. I know I bought a lot of stuff. So this has actually helped me, too. I've already started purging. I have currently 5 bags of things sitting on my sitting in my living room right now that I'm going to be donating. So check out Marie Kondo's Tidying Up on Netflix. Happy New Year. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I'm going to give people and let people know what your bio is because you're dope, yo. Natasha S. Alford is an award-winning journalist, host, speaker, and digital content creator. As deputy editor of The Griot, she reports on the most critical news and issues shaping society and culture, including criminal justice reform, education, politics, and entertainment. She's appeared on Power 105's Breakfast Club Sirius XM, Cheddar TV Live. And this summer, she wrote an op-ed about growing up Afro-Latina in the United States. And it was published in the in the New York Times. She is the 2018 Emerging Journalist of the Year for NABJ, which is the National Association of Black Journalists. She's a graduate of Harvard University and Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. You know, slight work. Where she earned a master's degree in broadcast journalism. Basically, Natasha is this epic journalist who y'all gotta know, and I'm so excited to have you on the show. Hey, girl.
Hey, girl. Hey, thank you so much.
So I always start my interview with my guests by asking, what did you want to do or be when you were growing up?
Oh, wow. So I would say the first thing I wanted to be was an artist. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, I was always drawing pictures. I was that girl in middle school who the girls were like, hey, can you draw a picture of me? So that's what I did throughout elementary school. And then when I got to high school, that's when I started to say I wanted to be a journalist because I was one of the editors of the school newspaper. But unfortunately, when I went to college, they didn't have a journalism major. And so my life just kind of ended up on a different path. And then, you know, things come full circle and here I am still.
But wait, so where did you end up majoring in college?
So when I got there, there was this program called Social Studies, which is basically like social science. And, you know, I think I went to a public high school, so regular public school, and I ended up going to Harvard, and I felt like I needed to prove myself while being there, really prove that I belong there. And the first thing I did was say, okay, I want to apply to a major where it's honors. And so, you know, I did like it, but I think in retrospect, I should have done something more creative. You know, I should have done something like visual arts or even African-American studies. But I think the lesson in that was, you know, even when you may take a step that seems like it's kind of off your destined path, if you really listen, if you listen to your intuition and you kind of listen for signs around you, you will end up getting back on track. So, yeah, I did the social studies thing, and then I ended up taking a job at a hedge fund, which was, you know, very typical for that campus. Often recruiters come and, you know, they're looking for black talent, so they grab you up. But about a year into that job, I again was like, you know, this, I don't feel like my purpose is in this. This looks really great on paper, but I feel like I should be doing something that is either uplifting or, you know, giving back to the community that I came from. So I left the hedge fund job and became a teacher. I took a $65,000 pay cut, and I, you know, went and I worked at a charter school in New York City, first as an assistant, really, as a fellow, and then I had to teach for America in D.C. and, you know, went into education policy. And that is when I got bit with the journalism bug.
So how did you make that move? Because you've done, so hedge funds, teacher, and then journalism. What was the big break? Since people would probably be like, ma'am, you don't have any experience in this.
Right. Like, how do you do it? Yeah. I love telling this story because I like to encourage people who feel like, you know, they may be the underdog or maybe too late. Like, it is not too late. So I was 27, I think, 27, 28. No, I was 27, actually applying to business school. This is another thing. Everybody was applying to business school in, like, you know, my mid-20s. That was, like, the thing to do. And so I was trying to emulate that model of success. So I'm working at an education policy shop out in California. I'm applying to business school. And I got asked to interview our CEO at a staff meeting. So I do the interview. When I finish, people are like, wow, you look like you really enjoyed that. Like, you looked in your element. You looked comfortable. And it really clicked for me that everything I've always liked to do had to do with writing, presenting, you know, interacting with people. Why didn't I ever go and pursue that dream? And so I secretly applied to journalism school while I was supposed to be studying for the GMAT just to see if I could get in, you know, just to see if I could make a case. And lo and behold, I ended up getting in. And once I got a scholarship, I was like, I think this is God basically being like, take a leap of faith. And so I sold all my furniture. I packed up my car and I drove from Sacramento to Chicago and started at Northwestern. And I say that living in Chicago was like one of the best years of my life because
Shot Town.
Yes, Chi-Town was, like, hands down my favorite experience on a personal level, but also just in my purpose life, you know, feeling like I have been struggling all through my 20s to find my thing. And even when things were good, it didn't feel like I was still doing what I was supposed to do. And when I did journalism, when I, you know, saw that first byline and did my first interview as a journalist, I was like, this is it. This is what I was meant to do.
So now you are at The Griot. You use a lot of video for the content that you do. Basically, from back then when you started your journalism till now, what have you seen has changed?
Yeah, I have seen a lot of shifts in the industry. So when I was in school at Northwestern, Medill, you know, it was kind of that strict journalism 101, right? It's still the old school rules of broadcasting and, you know, you don't ever express, like, emotion necessarily. Like, these are the techniques of journalism. But now I see that journalists are putting a lot more of their personality into their storytelling, and their brand is just as important as the stories that they do, because we're all on our phones, right? We're constantly connected to Instagram or Twitter, and so it's not even so much about being a part of some big network. It's like, do I trust you with the story? Do I trust you as a journalist to believe that this story is being told in a fair way? And so this whole idea of, like, you need to be at some big outlet or you need to be at one of the big three TV networks to have a following and all of that, those rules are out of the window. And that's one of the things that I really liked about being in digital, because I did TV news. I was a local TV news reporter, you know, out there, and I learned a lot. But there was a lot of freedom in digital to show my personality and to really advocate and tell stories in a way that went beyond, you know, a 90-second news package that was going to run on TV. So the industry literally just changed before my eyes. I think there are pros and cons to that, but I do think a lot more voices are in the conversation that we would have never heard before.
Do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
I'm definitely an extrovert.
Okay. So being very public on social, was that a challenge or not?
It was a transition, because if you look at my tweets from, like, way back in the day, they were super formal. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wasn't really posting, like, selfies or talking about my life. It was very, like, hey, I'm at this crime scene, and, like, this is what's happening. Over time, I've started to realize, like, you can show sides of who you are. You can show what you value. I can tell people, you know, I'm a daughter of a public school teacher, you know, so when I write about education, I'm talking about it from, like, a personal perspective, and I know what I'm talking about when I write about inner city schools. Or I was a teacher, so when I do a story about Black male educators and why they matter in the classroom, like, I'm doing that with, you know, some actual, like, experience. So, yeah, I think there's definitely been a shift. And I even, you know, I use this hashtag, the people's journalist, because I see myself as being a champion of the people when I go out and tell these stories, or if I'm in a certain room, I want people to feel like I'm advocating for them. I'm just not another person in the room who wants to be seen.
A lot of people who I talk to, you know, we all, I feel like there was a change that happened with everybody, probably 4 or 5 years ago, when Black Lives Matter was created and when we really started getting more stories about Black and brown folks being killed at the hands of police. How has that changed the way you've done the work that you've been doing?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, when the Michael Brown story broke, I was in TV news at the time. So I was, like, the only Black reporter, you know, in a newsroom.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
Watching the way that was hard. It was hard to go to work that day because there was so much I wanted to say. There was so much I feel like was even missing from the coverage. Now being at, you know, a Black media outlet, when something like that happens, I am unapologetic. You know, I'm unapologetic in asking critical questions. In giving airtime to families. And something that I've done in my role is I try to speak with families not just when all the cameras are there.
Yeah.
You know, the cameras come, everybody talks about it for 2 seconds, and then they forget that the fight continues. So I've spent a lot of time interviewing families who have become activists for their loved ones who died at the hands of police. And there was one particular woman in Brooklyn who her brother was killed by an off-duty police officer after a road rage incident. And he basically got off. This was the first case that was prosecuted. And so that family was just so heartbroken. And I followed them for a year as they continued to fight, but also as they did other work in the community to advocate. And I just saw them grow from just people who felt victimized to people who were really empowered. And so, you know, that was a story that I told. And I think that that's a story that you kind of get the freedom to do in Black media, because while the mainstream news moves on, you get to say, no, these people are still important, and this is why we need to pay attention to what's happening.
Man, that's real, because I know, I remember when the Mike Brown thing happened and when Trayvon got killed and how all of a sudden people's eyes were opened. What has been the most meaningful thing that you think you've done since?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard because, I mean, I think you can tell meaningful stories in different ways. Like, I've done some entertainment stories, too, that I feel like have been very important. Like, I remember interviewing Viola Davis.
Yes, queen.
I mean, she's just amazing, right? This is a person who you know that her soul and her spirit is just as rich as, like, her outside beauty. And Viola was talking about the way that society emphasizes outward beauty for women. And then when they hit a certain point in their life, it's like, well, what is my value beyond, you know, maintaining a certain appearance, or if I start to change, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, how do I evaluate myself? And so she gave this really powerful answer that ended up, you know, going viral on Twitter. And it's like, those stories matter just as much as a police brutality story, I tell, because it's about shifting the culture and consciousness. So, everything from mental health stories I've done, and I've been opening up about, you know, my own wellness and health journey, too, to the, you know, police brutality and the political stories. I covered the midterms, and I got to interview Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum and, you know, even Cory Booker. And it's like being a Black reporter in the room and asking questions for the Black community, like, I feel like that has also been really impactful for me, but also just for the discussions that we're having. So basically just saying, whatever the story is, I think there's a way you can make it powerful and meaningful for the community.
And you bring up something that I actually was going to bring up. And as I talk to my guests, it's really important to see what we do, but I also want to talk through some of the things we go through that people don't see. You recently shared that you were diagnosed with lupus 2.5 years ago, and that until recently you were hesitant to disclose that because of how it could potentially impact your career. Can you talk more about that and, like, how, about getting that diagnosis and how you've been managing?
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked that question, and I am so glad we're talking about this. So, you know, when I was diagnosed with lupus, it was my first year at the GRIO, and things were just starting to take off for me. I just got my first, like, gig hosting a press junket, you know, where you sit down with talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been feeling tired. I'd been feeling like some things were wrong, but, you know, like we normally do, we push through, right? I'm just like, I don't have time for going to the doctor right now. I have stories to do and places to be. And I woke up one morning and I couldn't bend my wrist. And I knew that something was wrong. And so I went to the doctor. They ran some tests. And at first they thought maybe it's arthritis. And then, you know, I came in. I had just turned 30. You know, 30, that is like a milestone year for us where we're turning up and we're celebrating, like, moving into adulthood. And they told me that I had lupus. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it meant for my career. But I knew that as a host, as somebody who was on camera, I didn't want anybody questioning what I could do. And so I literally, I actually was in the hospital that weekend with something we call a flare. That's when your immune system, your whole body kind of flares up and it's attacking itself. And I went straight from the hospital to my interview. But this is how you know God is present, and he makes his presence known, or her presence known. I was going to the interview, you know, just throwing my makeup together, doing my hair, just trying to look presentable. And I was sitting there researching the talent. I was going to interview Tashina Arnold. And so I'm looking on her Wikipedia page to do my research, and I see Tashina is an advocate for lupus.
And I
thought it was like a small sign from God to just say, you know, I'm with you through this, and to continue pushing forward. Because what are the chances that I'm diagnosed with lupus and then literally the person I'm going to interview, you know, is a lupus advocate? So I didn't tell her in that moment. You know, it was very quick. You sit down in front of the camera, you ask your question. But just being there with her, I was like, this is, I'm going to get through this. And so from there, you know, it was just a journey. Sometimes I was up. Sometimes I was taking my medication, you know, being healthy, getting rest. Other times I wasn't. And I was really pushing the limits because I was in denial. I'm like, I'm young. I feel fine. You know, nothing's going to happen. And whenever I would start pushing those limits, I wasn't taking my meds, I wasn't sleeping, I wasn't eating well, I would have a flare, or I would end up, you know, with pneumonia. Things that were really just, it made life hard. So I say all that to say, when you move from denial, when you move from fear, and then you walk in acceptance, you know, you walk in your courage and your confidence and your faith, you'll see your life change. And once I accepted that this is a part of my life, but I can manage it, things changed for me. I got healthier. You know, I was able to just not carry that guilt anymore. And then I was like, hey, I feel comfortable talking about this. Naturally, people like Nick Cannon, Selena Gomez, Toni Braxton, seeing them be open about their illness, but also their journey made me feel like if they can do it, I can do it too. And so, I shared my story at the end of 2018, and I have received nothing but love and support. And frankly, when you carry secrets, it can make you sick. I think it makes you sicker when you're carrying, you know, secrets and you're not getting support or community. It doesn't mean that you have to tell everybody what's going on, but you have to have some kind of space where you can be free. And once I started to talk about it, it became less of a thing. And now it's just, it's a part of my life, but it doesn't define everything that I am.
How has the lupus diagnosis changed how you operate day to day? If it has.
It really has. I mean, the first step is people in the lupus community or like chronic illness, there's something called spoon theory. And basically, every day you wake up, you have a certain amount of spoons, right? And so doing an activity will take away from those spoons. And so if you do one thing, it's a trade-off, and you may be left with, you know, only one or two spoons left for the day. So for me, I prioritize completely differently. You know, I don't waste energy. You know, I say no a lot more. I used to want to be there for everything and everybody and just feel really guilty if I couldn't come through and do a story or go to an event. Now I just have to choose. Like, if I do this thing, that means I can't do that. So saying no, prioritizing that which is actually important to me, and then actually blocking off time for wellness. So every week I do acupuncture. I go to physical therapy. I start 2019 with personal training sessions that are locked into my schedule. Basically, the regular habits of a healthy person, except that it's non-negotiable. Self-care used to be optional for me. Now it is mandatory.
Yo, that's super real, because a lot of us take it for granted. We're like, yeah, I should go work out. And then you look up 3 months later, have not. That's my story. So for right. you, now it's a requirement. Did that take a big shift, or was that one day you just like, I just got to do this?
Listen, I just got knocked on my ass. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I got knocked down. I was in the emergency room with a flare, and it's like, sis, you've had this illness for 2.5 years. There's medication. There's, you know, support for you. Now this is really on you. If you are you know, ill, that means you're not able to do the things that you love. And I wrote about this in the Medium piece, but I found out that I won the award for Emerging Journalist of the Year in the hospital.
Oh, wow.
I was I was in the emergency room with a flare because I had, you know, traveled internationally. I was all over. I was at this event, that event, and I didn't bring my medication with me, and my body just was overwhelmed. And so I had a fever, and I had some pneumonia symptoms. And I got the call from NABJ, like, congratulations, you know, you're this year's Emerging Journalist of the Year. And I, again, I took it as a sign that this is, you cannot enjoy your success, the success that you're working for, if you don't prioritize yourself. And when you are talent, and I say this for anybody, but especially if you work on camera, you are the product. You are the product. So if you are not well, that means that, you know, you aren't able to exercise your gifts and your talent. And so that was it for me. That was a turning point. And I was like, I'm going to prioritize wellness. And by doing that, I think my work has been better. I've generally just been better. And my mindset is better. And ultimately, that's what it takes to be successful in the long run.
So what made you finally want to disclose and talk about it publicly? And has it affected your career?
So far, it's been nothing but support. I think what really made me want to come forward is I felt like a lot of people were congratulating me. Like I was having all these wins last year, right? I'm on the Breakfast Club. I have this thing published in the New York Times. And like people were saying congratulations, but I felt like there was more to the story. You know, they were only seeing something that was almost surface level in a way. And I thought that the story was actually powerful, more powerful, if they understood like the lessons that I was learning along the way about wellness, about what, you know, self-care really is and what success really is. Because if you are having these wins in one space, but you're sacrificing your health, then that's not really winning. That's not really success. And so I thought it would free me also to live a better life if I could explain to people, hey, this is why I'm making these decisions. These are the changes that are happening. And more importantly, it was about helping somebody else who I know needed to hear the story. And people have emailed me, they've reached out saying, you know, that they either have invisible illnesses also, or, you know, my story helped them. And so for me, that's worth it. And ultimately, like, I think my future is in God's hands. So, you know, however people perceive it or however they perceive me doesn't matter, because I've been able to succeed in spite of this. And so, I basically feel like I'm walking in freedom, and there's just really like no trade-off for that.
Ooh, that's real. And I think as we start this new year, you know, a lot of people have the resolutions. I'm going to the gym. You might just inspire a lot of folks to be like, you know what? Let me actually do more than just go to the gym this one time.
Yeah, listen, appreciate your help when you have it, because there may be a time where the things that you take for granted become much harder, right? So it's like if you have the ability to do it now, and it's a low lift, it's just a matter of will yourself to do it and invest in yourself, because it's ultimately going to pay off.
Absolutely. So are you, what is next for you in terms of what do you want for your career?
Well, this is like a vision board conversation.
Hey,
I love it.
Let's do it. Look, it's the beginning of the year. Let's do this vision boarding.
Right. Let's manifest our vision. So my goal is to continue to do impactful journalism, to be an advocate and a champion for people who often are ignored in our conversations about current affairs or what matters. And I'm also going to continue to be an advocate for diversity in newsrooms. So, you know, this week we saw this thing with CBS, where CBS got dragged, not having like a single black reporter on this particular, you know, campaign team. And I've just been speaking out about the importance of diversity through NABJ and telling the history of black journalists who, you know, black journalists, there was a time when we couldn't catch a cab or we would show up for a story and they would think we were the maid and turn us away. You know, so we bring something to journalism, and I want to continue to be a voice for that. So outside of the storytelling, I'm going to be telling more of my own story, too. You know, you mentioned the New York Times piece. I'm African-American and Puerto Rican, so I come from, like, a multicultural background, and that story of the Afro-Latina were often ignored, you know, in mainstream Latinx press. Latinos are always seen as one way. They're light skin, you know, they have straight hair, they have certain features, and that's just not true. It's not representative of, you know, the diversity and the beauty within all of these different cultures. And so I'll be telling a little bit more of my story growing up, you know, Afro-Latina, basically a black girl who is Latina. And I'm going to be doing some writing on my blog. It's called American Negra, which is just, you know, negra is a Latin term for black, a black girl or a black woman. So yeah, it's telling my story and telling other people's stories and really gearing up for 2020 because, yeah.
Girl, we're going to have to pray about it. We're going to have to take it to the altar, and I'm just like, I don't want. I'm so afraid. I don't trust America to do the right thing anymore. Well, ever, actually. Not even anymore. I don't think any of us really trusted America in any way, but then we were like, oh, okay. Yeah, the work that you do is also, since you have to be in the loop constantly, that stuff is stressful, which is why I'm like, on top of personal stuff, I think journalists deserve all types of props for not having crazy high blood pressure every day. Like,
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, Lovey, you are in the digital sphere, so you've seen everything, right? The way that people comment and the clapbacks, it's energy draining sometimes, as much as it can be, you know, energizing to be a part of the digital space. But yeah, we go through it, and you've seen it from Jemele Hill, you know, Abby Phillip, April Ryan. I mean, I admire and respect these women so much, and they're on the front lines. And even we take heat when you work in black media. You know, there's a mix of opinions in the black community. We just did this whole R. Kelly thing, and
my God,
the people who are coming at my neck for calling out R. Kelly and saying, you know, let's defend young black women and boys too. You know, let's end this culture of like sexual predatory behavior. People were coming at us.
Can you believe that even is a thing? That like even the most basic thing gets us in trouble. And I had Jemele on, she was talking about how like how much trouble she got into for saying Trump is a racist, but like how is that a hot take when it's fact? How is it a hot take to say R. Kelly deserves prison for being a predator? That I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't understand either. But I do know we have to be vocal, you know, that we can't bow to that pressure. Because at the end of the day, history is going to judge, you know, what's going down. And I'm going to be on the right side of history. So I'm going to say that, you know, being a predator and targeting underage girls or boys, that is not cool. And we need to change it because it creates apathy and it enables other people to do the same thing. And I'm going to say that, you know, we should not take the bait when Donald Trump tells us to turn against immigrants, you know, and that it's more about politics than it really is about caring about black American interests. Like, we got to take those stances and we got to base it in facts and just educate. And the people who receive it will receive it. But at the end of the day, like, this is why we do the work. It's all about the truth.
But how do you deal with the social media noise? For those of us who are very vocal online, who are writing, who are tweeting, who are black women behind a keyboard, we get a lot of heat. How do you deal with when the noise gets super loud, when you say something that all of a sudden gets you negative attention?
Right. Well, I would say the first step is really about your foundation. So I don't start my day hopping immediately on social media. You know, I really try to base and ground myself in, like, the real world. You know, so I wake up, I read my devotion, will say a prayer. I don't do it every day, you know, just to be clear. There are some days where I do open my inbox first, but I try not to be defined by my work, right? Because at the end of the day, I'm still who I am. So nobody can tell me who I am if I know who I am.
Facts.
But secondly, this actually, it's funny you're asking this question. A dude came for me this week on Twitter. He said, he looked at my page and he said, why is a Dominican working for an African-American news website?
Wow.
And I about fell out because I'm like, but I'm Puerto Rican. I'm not Dominican, first of all. you looked at the emoji flag. You got it all wrong. Second of all, I'm African-American also, right? And so you just like, how can I take a person seriously who didn't even bother to Google me before they came for me? You know what I'm saying? Like,
facts.
People project negative energy. They want attention that they wouldn't otherwise get. And so you have to realize when something is an energy trap, right? When something is meant to suck you down. But at the same time, it's okay to show up to a fight that you want to go to. I don't go to every internet fight that I'm invited to, but
right.
Sometimes I selectively engage because there's a lesson to be learned. And in this particular instance, this was an educational moment about, one, there is a such thing as the African diaspora.
Yep.
And guess what? Multiple ethnicities and cultures are a part of that. We were dropped off by slave ships in different locations, but we are Black. So there's that. And secondly, you know, I am also African-American, and you cannot deny me my, you know, cultural history. And then also, like, what about our community? You know, why do we think this way in terms of division? And so there was, like, a whole conversation that I had, and that's why I showed up to that fight and I engaged. But there are some people who I'm like, okay, I'm not going to go back and forth with you on this, you know,
right.
Because I just have other things to do. So ultimately, I would encourage anybody who is a writer to be grounded, to be really like sure of them, be sure of yourself, you know, be open, of course, to criticism and conversation that is well-meaning, but also be able to discern when it is not for your benefit or for the benefit of anyone else. And I think that you can walk away feeling good. We got to be able to stand for something.
Right.
You know, or else, like, what are we doing here?
What are we doing here? So you've already touched on some of these things. I always end with asking my guests, how are you taking care of yourself? What are the things that you'd like to do to pamper yourself? Let us know.
Oh, okay. This is good. let's see. Well, this week, I am going to acupuncture. I really enjoy acupuncture. It is meant to, you know, stimulate blood flow to your body. And I'm going to acupuncture to continue to work on getting some blood flow to my joints. They also use a really nice heating lamp when you go into acupuncture. For people who don't know what it is, they stick small needles in your body. And this is actually history fact. The Black Panthers popularized acupuncture in the United States for treatment of people who had addiction, to help addictions. And so they would do community acupuncture centers and help people to kind of, you know, meditate and really get zen rather than turning to drugs. So random fact for you guys, but that's part of what really drew me to look into it. I enjoy it. I love it. Something else that I do, I go to, you know, personal training with a trainer. Right now I'm doing it about 3 times a week.
Okay.
And that is, yeah, whenever I feel, you know, maybe sadness coming, because that happens. I'm not happy all the time.
Right.
I have things that I worry about. I have things that, you know, I want to happen in my life. Whatever is going on, I've always found that being active really changes my emotion. You know, it really just kind of like wakes me up, and the first step is to actually get into the gym. So my self-care has been going to the gym and taking care of my body, which is my temple. You know, it's really just the thing that, again, is my work too, right? So by investing in that, it's been great, and I've really enjoyed it. So, yeah, that's my self-care, guys.
You're not going to massages. Are you going to get your nails done? Vacation?
No. Okay. So this is, some people are going to laugh at this. Another thing I do for self-care is I go to Carnival in the Caribbean.
Yes. Why laugh? That makes sense.
Carnival is therapy. Anybody who's gone knows. And that's just because soca music is so positive. It's so uplifting. It's all about unity and, you know, fun and vibes. And so, and I play mas, so I, you know, masquerade. I wear the feathers. I do the whole thing. And I kid you not, like, no matter what my body looks like, because, you know, we all hit that time where it's like, oh, I need to lose 10 pounds. I need to lose 5 pounds. No matter what my body looks like, when I put on the costume, I feel like a different person. You know, I feel like the best version of myself. And I just have the best time. So if you are looking for a self-care turn-up, I highly recommend Carnival. Okay, I've done Trinidad and Tobago 3 times. I've done a crop over in Barbados. I've done Carnival in Jamaica, and I've done Carnival in Miami. And every single one has been amazing. So that's my self-care, if you guys want to get in on that.
Yes. No, thank you so much for that. I love asking people that because it gives me a window into what folks are doing. And for some ideas, I've actually been thinking about doing acupuncture for about a year just to try it, but I haven't tried it yet. So,
girl, go get it done. Let me know what you think when you try it out.
You might have just given me the push I needed. So, thank you so much, Natasha. Love having you on Rants and Randomness. I think people are going to love hearing about your experience and about your work. And I am excited that you are out here doing this work every single day.
Thank you so much, Lovey. Thank you for the work you're doing, too. I'm glad we're having these conversations. And, you know, I just want to wish everybody in 2019 well wishes. Take care of yourself. That's what matters most.
Yes. Have a great rest of the day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Yo, shout out to Natasha Alford for joining me. Y'all, follow her on social media. She's at Natasha S. Alford on Twitter and Instagram. That's NatashaSAlford. Y'all definitely follow her. She's Natasha S. Alford News on Facebook. Much love to Chicago Recording Company for partnering with me on this podcast. Y'all subscribe to this podcast everywhere where podcasts are, wherever you get your podcast fix, basically, and rate it. And if you love it, share it. Let people know on social to listen to this dope podcast. And follow Rants and Randomness on Twitter, at Rants Randomness, no and. On Instagram, we are at Rants and Randomness. And if you have any questions, feedback, any love you want to share with me, loveyrants@gmail.com is the email address. And as always, you can follow me on social media. I am at Lovey everywhere. See you on the next episode.